and welcome to another episode of the Send Mum Club podcast. I'm your host, Gemma. Thank you so much for choosing to listen. This is the parenting podcast with a difference because it is all about children with Send and everything that comes under that rather large umbrella. And the more people that I speak to on this podcast, the more I'm realizing how big that umbrella really is. So just a quick little thing before we start. I have had the serious mum guilt today. Oh my God, today has not been a good day. I had to go and get my hair done, which sounds, doesn't it, like it's, oh, gorgeous, get to go to a salon and get your hair done and all of that. Not quite, because unfortunately, both mine and my husband Ben's parents live bloody miles away. So I haven't got the luxury of being able to phone like my mum or my mother-in-law and go, oh, do me a favour, can you just have the baby while I nip and get my hair done? So Leo is like a Velcro child attached to me the entire time, which when he was a baby was actually relatively easy because they just don't move, do they, when they're tiny. But Leo is now nearly three. I hate saying that. I've been clinging on to 2.5, but he's 3 at the beginning of October, so that's kind of gone. And nearly 3-year-olds don't really enjoy sitting in the hairdressers for what turned out to be over 4 hours. So there was a lot of Bluey on YouTube, which made me feel awful because obviously screen time is way more than I would want it to be in that situation. Then I'm also feeling like, oh my God, no one in here's got their kids with them. And if mine kicks off, then they're going to hate me because they are having that nice salon experience. And then it all just got very hot, very bothered. I was there for much longer than it was meant to happen. Suffice to say, it all ended terribly. His nappy leaked. I had to strip him off. He was roasting hot. He was crying on my lap while the hairdryer was blowing in his face. Dreadful. I then get home thinking, okay, bad time over. The kids had left the house in an absolute state. And the dog, oh my God, the dog. If you heard my Father's Day special with Ben, you'll have literally heard my dog on that episode. She is in my bad books, big time. So my lovely new friend Sam, and Sam listens to this podcast, for my birthday, which is upcoming, gave me, thankfully, a mini box of Hotel Chocolat chocolates. So thank you, Sam. They would have been lovely had the dog not decided to break into the bag. And yes, chocolate is poisonous for dogs. Thankfully, she didn't get her little teeth into too many of them. So she's fine, but they are ripped apart, destroyed by the dog. So me and the dog, Dolly, I'm not talking. Anyway, sometimes I just like to share my disastrous days because I feel like if somebody does that to me, it just makes me feel better about my own life. So that was the reasoning behind that. Maybe an overshare, but there we go. So I want to talk to you about today's episode and today's guest. My guest is the lovely Becky. Now, me and Becky have crossed paths because she listens to In Demand, which is the radio station that I do a breakfast show on. So we follow each other on Instagram kind of through that. And it was actually her that put me in touch with her friend Kelly, who I had on the podcast talking about Kobe with his limb difference. He was the one that was in that amazing Netflix hit Toxic Town. Great episode to listen back to if you haven't, by the way. But anyway, Becky is here to talk about her son, Bobby, who has pectus excavatum. Now, I know I've said that right because I double checked in this episode and in this chat with Becky. So I wrote it down like phonetically so I didn't get it wrong, as well as an issue with his right lung and also another diagnosis on top of that, which I'll let Becky go into more detail about. Now, this is a really interesting chat because we talk about funding for surgery, which Becky felt was absolutely necessary in Bobby's case and was proved right, actually. But the funding wasn't there because it got cut. Now, there's a big whole story about that. And Becky's quite inspirational in trying to get that changed. This was another episode, actually, where I learned quite a lot. Becky was talking about things like individual healthcare plans, which I'd never heard of. I'd only ever heard of an EHCP. We talk about individual funding requests for surgery. Again, I'd never heard of that. And we talk about Bobby's journey up and to the point of surgery and then how much of a difference it made to his life when he had that surgery at 15. And the other bit of this chat that I really enjoyed talking to Becky about was how her family navigated Bobby going to school and learning how to deal with other children staring or asking questions. And that's something that I actually found super helpful when I'm thinking about Leo going to school when I'm not always with him all the time, which is something that absolutely terrifies me. So I'll stop waffling on because this is a great episode. Let's get into it. Vicky, thank you for joining me on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I've already had a guest on because of you, haven't I? Because you said that you would love to come on, and you also recommended your friend, and I loved her episode.
Oh, they're just brilliant, aren't they? Such a gorgeous family.
If you haven't heard that episode, it was about Kobe's limb difference. So definitely go back and listen if you get a chance, because it's a brilliant episode, that. But Becky, we are here to talk about you and your son, Bobby, aren't we?
Yeah.
First of all, just tell me a little bit about him. Like, what's he up to? How old is he to start with?
So he's 16. He'll be 17 in September.
He's just had his prom, hasn't he? Because I saw on your Instagram and it looked amazing.
Yeah, well, you know, we were really lucky because the Ferrari owners club, when they heard his story, they got somebody arranged it all for him and got somebody to do it for him for free. So
that's a prom that he's not going to forget, isn't it?
No,
I'm not going to try and say this because I know that I'm going to say it wrong. So could you please explain about Bobby's chest?
So Bobby's got had a condition. I don't know if I say has. I'm not sure. So it's a condition called pectus excavatum.
I would have said that. I'm glad you did it.
And basically what that means is he has an excess growth of cartilage on his ribs that pushes his sternum inwards. This was discovered at his 6-week checkup at the GP after he was born.
Oh, okay. So it's not something that was picked up on a scan.
No. Bobby also has a really rare condition called, so he's got a CCAM, which is a congenital cystic adenomatoid malformation of his right lung. And he also has 2 bronchial atresias. So that's a blockage in the bronchus in the upper and lower lobe of his right lung. So basically his full right lung's knackered. And then we noticed the chest at his 6-week checkup, but the CCAM and the bronchial atresias was a really strange journey. So they diagnosed the CCAM. And she said the way she explained it to us was, I can't remember how many years she said, but she said in subsequent years, up until a couple of years ago, mums were advised to terminate the pregnancies because they don't know if babies will be compatible with life because of this lung malformation. But we've found with some of the pregnancies we've let go full term, actually some of the kids have been living a happy, healthy life. So she was looking for something called high drops. So she said with the cysts, what they can do is they can develop like fluid around them, and that fluid can just get more and more and then compromise baby's heart and you know, can be fatal. So every 2 weeks, while it was beautiful getting to see my baby every 2 weeks, and obviously every 2 weeks I was skipping out because I was thinking, all right, that's done. He's fine. We're doing well. And then just bizarrely at 32 weeks, I've still got the reports downstairs, and she put about 20 exclamation marks. No CCAM found. So we were like, oh my God, this is just bizarre. So then when he was born, we had like a room full of people and doctors came and everything, and he was fine, you know, came out crying and breathing and everything that he should be doing. And then fast forward to about when he was about 3, he started to like vomit. He started to get like a blue tinge around his lips. And he was playing football with dad on the park, and he just started to vomit, and it's like he couldn't catch his breath. So we went to see this amazing lady who just became part of our family. That was Bobby's surgeon, Miss Bizarrovich, and she was just fantastic. And she really just took us under her wing, and she just looked after him from there on. So they did a CT scan. At that point, nothing seemed to have changed. So she referred us on to Leeds to like a paediatric, I think he was like a thoracic, like a cardiothoracic specialist. And he was brilliant as well. He was really good. But as the years went on, Bobby had another CT scan. And he said, actually, now we can see the lung more clearly because it's a little bit bigger. It isn't a CCAM. It's 2 separate bronchial atresias. And then when he was younger, we'd just like have constantly back and forward to A&E. He'd have constant recurrent chest infections. It was just like, I mean, obviously because I'm from the Wirral, but I live in Hull. I got to the point where previously I was a dental nurse, and my boss said to me, just get his notes, get a copy of his notes and his diagnosis and just take them with you in the car anywhere you go. Because, like, we ended up in Arrow Park one weekend and he was just like, he just couldn't catch a breath. And they were giving him all kinds of, like, inhalers and asthma drugs and this, that and the other. And it just didn't seem to make a difference. So I'd got to the point where I had a picture of his scan and I'd just, like, show it to the doctor and say, look, this is what we're dealing with. And that just really seemed to make a difference. Because although, I mean, bizarrely, even some doctors didn't even know what the condition was, to show them a scan so they can see what they're dealing with. And that visual was so much more helpful.
I've had conversations with other mums along these lines of, you know, having to request your child's notes and having to write everything down. And although it's good that it worked, like, as a mum, you shouldn't be having to carry around pictures of scans, should you, like that?
And that's how our lives have gone on. I work in operating theatres, so I'm a healthcare professional in that capacity. And it's sad to see the disparity, because my colleagues are brilliant. I mean, obviously I'm biased, but my colleagues are brilliant and they really, you know, they really want to help and they really want to do a good job. But then sometimes when you get in front of a certain healthcare professional and they're just dismissive, it kind of just makes you want to dig in deeper, especially when it's people that don't understand the condition. And it got better as time went on. We did actually eventually hit a point where he wasn't getting chest infections anymore and he wasn't particularly poorly. But then we had new challenges. So from quite an early age, it was apparent that Bobby got frustrated easily. And this was highlighted at nursery and at school. The first school weren't very good at coping with him and suggested that maybe it was his lung malformation and his chest wall malformation that was making him tired. So he was getting frustrated more easily. But we just went through the motions to the point where Bobby was coming home bruised, marked, he was being restrained. With my fairness head on, if you like, looking back now, the schools just weren't set up to deal with kids with additional needs. They didn't know what they were doing. They didn't have the tools or the resources to be able to help him. And we had the first headmaster was just awful. He was just not a very nice man, not very understanding or compassionate. And he referred Bobby to a behavioural unit. And
sorry to interrupt, how old was Bobby at this point?
I think he must have been about 6.
So really young.
Yeah, so we're still navigating the world, so still trying to, you know, find out about himself and how he copes with his emotions. And they came out and they assessed him and they said, we're not the provision for him. But then the headmaster was saying, we're not the provision for him. So we were just like, oh my God, like just stuck in this no man's land of what do we do? How do we help our child? So we decided to move him schools and he did get on a lot better there. And they said straight away, this kid's got ADHD. And I was like, well, I did think, but obviously because we got so much pushback from the other school. So we set the wheels in motion to get the assessment done, but it took years. And when he was actually at the front of the queue, lockdown hit. So it was all remote. So that all got sorted out. And then fast forward to going to secondary school. And my neighbour, her kids had gone to the same school. And she said, there's this teacher there. She's an SEND director. You need to make yourself known to her. She is brilliant. So I did. And I'd listed all the things that Bobby had going on and all his conditions and stuff. And again, she just took him under her wing. She was just brilliant. But she was so quick thinking. Like, I always said to her, do you think he's going to need an EHCP? And she said, no. She said, we're well enough equipped to deal with Bobby's challenges. So she said, I've got strategies and things that I can put in place here for him that we already know have worked for other children. So we'll try them first and then we'll just progress that way. So we had an IHCP.
Oh, what's that? I've not heard of one of those.
So that's an individual health and care plan.
Okay.
So it's kind of one step before the EHCP. So it's put in place between the parents. There's some input from doctor's reports and test results and things like that. And then the school. So I thought it was a nice interim step to try. And obviously because she was just brilliant anyway, it worked. And it saved us the stress of going through the arduous process of applying for an EHCP. And I've got friends and people that I know that have applied for them and said what a horrible process it is and long and drawn out. So it was really nice. Like I felt like somebody was actually finally looking out for my boy. And little, she would do little things, like she would say, I've noticed he's worse, like if he's hungry. So she'd say, we'll just get a bag of snacks for him in the office. And just the tiniest little things like that just help so much. Reverting back to the pectus excavatum, he was told most of his life by the guy in Leeds that there's no reason why we can't operate on this. You know, he's a good candidate. But what happens with pectus excavatum is when the kids hit puberty and they have the adolescent growth spurt, things tend to get a lot worse because the shoulders broaden. Obviously, everything grows. So it got worse.
And by worse, do you mean more pronounced?
Yeah. So, I mean, I listened to your podcast the other day. I think it was Kelly's one, actually, where you were saying about deformity. And now, even as a healthcare professional and working on the charity, I don't like that word. I know it's factually correct.
Was it that somebody had said that to Kelly?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, but I just don't think it sounds very nice.
No, absolutely not.
In a medical capacity, it's kind of, it's the factual word that, you know, that's what you would use to describe it.
There's other factual words though.
Yeah, yeah. And I always say, you know, I would even favour malformation over deformity. Or, you know, it's this chest isn't the same as other kids. It's as simple as that.
Referring to Kelly, I mean, the correct term is limb difference, isn't it? So Kobe hasn't got the bottom half of his arm, has he? And I guess, well, that's obviously why you brought it up. The sum of the language that would be used to describe Kobe is obviously outdated. There's essentially, across the board, quite a lot of outdated language still going on, isn't there?
And I think what you get is a crossover between medical professionals terming a condition rather than talking about a patient as a person.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're all guilty of it. And I suppose from a healthcare professional's point of view, it's that disassociation. So by talking about a patient in a factual term and talking about what they find, they're able to disassociate that emotional connection. But for the parent or for the patient, it's just not nice.
No.
But Bobby he never really worried about it. He went to... We actually, when we first started to really notice it, it was a bit of a taboo subject. We didn't talk about it and we weren't sure. He was our first child. We were new parents. We were quite young. And we were like, oh God, you know, how do we navigate this? And it was his nursery nurse and he come home and he said, oh, Elaine said I got crumbs in my egg cup. So I was like, so me and Mark were a bit like, how do we feel about like taking the mick out of his
Yeah.
It was malformation and we were like, actually, he really liked it, so we'll just go with it. So that was a big turning point for us because we kind of hit a point where we were like, he was happy. We were taking his lead. He was happy to apply humour.
When you said it was a taboo subject, do you mean between you and your husband or do you mean between you two and Bobby?
Sort of between our family and other people.
Right, okay.
So, if he went swimming or if he ever had his top off, we'd kind of be looking, thinking, oh God, you know, are people looking at him? How's he going to feel? And we tried to shield him from it and tried to protect him from it. When actually, he was just like, I'm not bothered, it's funny. So whereas we didn't actually want people laughing at him,
No, of course not.
To laugh with him was something different.
Yeah.
So she really helped us break the stigma on that. And we were really grateful for that. And then I remember being at a christening once and he took his top off. All the kids were running around with the tops off because they were roasting. And I remember this boy looking at him and like looking at his own chest and looking at him. And then he did this and like sucked his breath in to see if he could make his chest do the same. And I just thought, oh God, that's so cute. But, you know, people, adults, kids, whoever, they're all going to be inquisitive.
How has that kind of changed as he's got older? Because I think things like that, when children are smaller, they tend to care less, don't they? Other kids aren't as bothered. They don't really care. But then I guess as you get older, as you hit puberty, as kids around you get older and you start to kind of compare, which is obviously natural, do you feel like that changed?
Well, I used to get, I wouldn't say bullied, I used to get teased. There was one particular boy, used to call him Iron Man. And then he used to go swimming quite a lot. And there was one girl at swimming one day and she kept staring. And she was getting closer and closer to him and looking and really having a good look. And I just said to Bobby, why don't you go and talk to her? Why don't you go and ask her to ask you some questions and come and have a good look at it? You know, break those walls down. And then in the second school that he went to, the second primary school, they were planning swimming lessons, but it was for the whole year group. Mm-hmm. So his pastoral support said, what we think might be a good idea is to give Bobby the control and give Bobby the ownership of it. And we've asked him how he would feel about doing a presentation to the year group about his malformation. And I was like, God, that's brilliant. So I asked Bobby how he felt about it. And we sat and planned it and we put his scan pictures in and some pictures and all that. And I've still got the video now. And he's like, he just loved it. It's just, and he was like, Mum, is this right? And Mum, what's this called? And me and Dad were just sat in the class just like, oozing with pride.
That's such a lovely idea though, isn't it? Because I guess a lot of the staring and potentially like people talking about him is because people don't understand. So if he stood up there and gone, this is what it is, this is why, this is what it means, I guess it removes all of that, doesn't it? Immediately, because everybody knows.
Yeah. And I used to say quite a lot, I used to have this little phrase that I always used to put on Facebook, educate, don't discriminate.
Yeah.
So if that person's comfortable with doing that and sharing their condition with other people, that's got to be a safe space. And obviously the teachers mediated that, which was the safest space to be. So then growing up and going into secondary school after that, he kind of had this sense of ownership. And this same boy followed him on to secondary school and still called him Iron Man. And he just laughed. And he's like, he owned it. And on his last day at school, you know, when they all sign each other's shirts, this boy's written on his shirt, Iron Man. And he kind of took that on as a positive.
It's nice to hear that, because I think that's something that I am concerned about. You know, when you think about your child going to school and having a difference in whatever way that is, it does make you feel anxious as a parent, doesn't it? And I'm, you know, Leo's too small to kind of have those types of conversations with, but it's always good to find out how other people did. I mean, obviously, you know, our situations are very different with our children, but it's just good to know how other people navigated that thing of, yes, you're different. Yes, people are going to ask you questions or look at you, but this is a nice way to deal with it.
I think that's the key. Also, so as a parent, you're not feeling like you need to be confrontational with people, or you're not taking it personally. The best way we found with Bobby was just to give him the tools to deal with it, because we couldn't always be there to protect him. Or
yeah, and that's scary though, isn't it?
Yeah. I suppose we were lucky. Ended up being really resilient and wore that humour with pride. So that's kind of what got him through. But yeah, it all stemmed from that nursery nurse.
How did his ADHD kind of play into that? Because I guess from the beginning of your story, you've got one diagnosis that turned out to be wrong. You've got the pectus excavatum. Have I got that right? Yeah. And then you have the issue with his right lung as well. Well, I guess maybe a better question is, when you got that diagnosis of ADHD, how did you feel? And I don't mean how did you feel about the ADHD. I guess I mean more, how did you feel about it on top of what was already going on?
There was a lot of people saying to me, you don't need to label him. Why does he need a diagnosis? Like, he's just a little boy. And I was like, I know, but he needs help. We need help. And it did open so many doors. Having that diagnosis and just having that recognition opened so many more doors for us.
I love the sentiment behind why label, but actually in practice, it's not really that simple, is it?
Yeah. I remember we went to a parenting class once because we didn't really understand ADHD, neurodiversity. And me and my husband went to this class. It was run by a charity called Kids. And actually it was my university, when I went to university to study being an ODP, she said, there was a lady there and gave us all these resources and said, talk to kids because they can help you mediate with the school. And she said, just go to this parenting class. It just teaches you about neurodiversity. You'll just open your eyes. You might learn something. You might learn nothing. And I never forget, they played this video and it started off with somebody switching the telly on. Then the kettle was boiling. Then the clock was ticking. Then the tap was dripping. Then the front door bell was going and they had it on full blast. Oh. And I was just like, oh my God, this is horrendous. And they were like, this is how kids with neurodiversity feel. And that was like, again, another light bulb moment where we were just like, wow, God, you know, this must be how Bobby's feeling. And with everything else and all, like the illnesses that he was having and all the hospital appointments he was having to go to, we really were just like, we just really need to fight for this kid because we felt like nobody else was at such a young age. And I just became this terrier mom. I just wouldn't have no for an answer. Fast forward to 14. So the surgeon in Leeds said 14 would be the best age to do the surgery. Bring him back when he's 14. And it was actually the respiratory specialist that said, I've noticed it's starting to get a little bit worse. What we'll do is we'll get ahead and I'll send you back to Leeds. So we went to Leeds and we saw a different doctor. He'd retired. So the surgeon that we saw said, I'm really sorry, you've had a wasted journey. You've come expecting surgery for Bobby's pectus excavatum, but the NHS have cut the funding for it. So we were like, well, we know there's been funding cuts, do you know, but is there any way around it? Can we appeal? Is there anybody we can speak to? Can we put it in a complaint? And she was just really dismissive. And she was like, no. And there's no evidence to suggest that this surgery will have any benefit for him. She wasn't even going to examine him. So they measure the depth of the pectus excavatum in, it's called a Haller index.
Okay.
So it's like a calculation of the width and the depth of the thoracic space. So I said, well, I need to know what his Haller index is. And she said it was 4.3. And then I'd said about going private. So I said, you know, could we go private? And she said, well, no, there's nobody that really does it. So there's something on the NHS called an IFR, an individual funding request. So you can submit an IFR if you've got exceptional circumstances or if it's a really severe case. And this can be the case for all kinds of treatment, surgery. So because the pectus excavatum was deemed cosmetic, they were saying, we're not doing any. So she'd said, there's a guy in Middlesbrough doing it privately. You know, you could speak to him. She gave me his name, Mr. Dunning. So we were like, right, okay. So I'd gone away and I'd had a Google and I joined this Facebook pectus group. And I realised there were just everybody in this group was just talking about this Mr. Dunning and how wonderful he is. And every now and then he'd just comment. So I'd emailed him and just said, look, this has happened. I don't know what to do. Where it is and how deep it is, you can't tell me that that won't have some kind of benefit to his lung and heart, lungs and heart. And he was like, no, there's no evidence. Because everything on the NHS, everything medical is evidence-based.
Yeah.
So, you know, they do all these wonderful research, this wonderful research and trials and stuff, and then they can say, look, it's been tried and tested, so this is safe for our patients, which is brilliant. But I think sometimes they hide behind that, and they're not looking at the patient, they're not looking at the person, they're looking at a paper.
I mean, what you've said kind of, I'm not medical in any way, but it almost sounds a little bit like common sense. Like if he's having issues with his lung function and then something is taking up space there where it doesn't need to. I mean, it's not, it can only help, can't it?
It's just logic.
Yeah.
But in all fairness, his argument always was, look, he's got a knackered lung anyway. If you fix his chest, it's not going to make his lung function any better. And okay. I said, maybe not lung function. I said, but it will make his lung capacity better. I said to him, he's got one fully working lung on the left and he's still got one fully working small lobe on the right. I said, so let's give that a better chance. He said, but the best advice I can give you, and I've jumped ahead to your questions here, but he said, the best advice I can give you is keep him well exercised. Because if you can keep that lung working to its optimal performance, it'll give him a better chance.
And that's exactly the same with CF as well, isn't it?
Yeah. So the exercise and stuff, even though I'd be stood on the side of the pitch and just thinking, oh my God, like this poor kid. And he was just so proud. Like, it's just, you could just tell he was digging in. But I've got tons of photos where he'd run and then he'd be really out of breath. The game would still be playing on, but he'd just be leaning over like this, and we'd laugh and we'd say, oh, you know, he's doing his little catch a breath pose. And it was just weird. I was stood there watching him this day and thinking, oh God, this poor kid. And then this surgeon emailed me and he's like, yeah, do you want to go see your GP, get a referral, we'll have a look, see what we can do. The Society of Cardiothoracic Surgeons have arranged a seminar conference in London to discuss how we can potentially move things on and how we can potentially get this back on the NHS. So there was a group of really headstrong surgeons that just really wanted to put this back on the NHS and really did believe that it would make a difference. There was loads of people there, but most importantly, there was families there, patients, parents, people who had it done, people who are desperate to get it done. There was even one lady, bless her, who'd lost her daughter from having the surgery, but wanted to show up to support us. I kind of got the bit between my teeth. I'd started an early day motion, so I spoke to my local MP and he started an early day motion for me. So I was trying to gather signatures on this early day motion to say, look, you know, this shouldn't be happening. I'd done several interviews. So I'd done a BBC radio interview. I'd done a Viking interview.
That's your local radio station, isn't
it? Viking, yeah. And then we made contact with ITV Calendar News. And on the day, the Independent were meant to be attending this conference to do a write-up on it. And nobody showed up on the day. And then in comes me with ITV. So,
I love that.
So Mr. Dunning was like, yeah, great. And we got full coverage of the conference. And we really gained some traction. And obviously, one thing we do agree on with all the, you know, the big chiefs in the NHS and all the surgeons and everybody that was there on that day, the one thing that we all agreed on was the thing that has the most impact is when you hear the patient stories. Yeah. So there was a couple of patients and a couple of parents that stood up and talked on that day. And another lady who's got children with pectus malformations, and she wrote a book. So she collected, I think it was 41 stories of 41 families. And she put this book together for this conference. the SCTS, I think they funded it, and everybody got given copies on the day. But that really just highlighted the impact of how Pectus excavatum can be so detrimental to people's health.
Is that the book that you'd emailed me?
Yeah.
At the beginning of that, I just want to fact check this before I say that this is true. At the beginning of that book, it says that the treatment since 2019 had, the funding had been taken away for the treatment for the surgery, but only in England. And it says at the beginning of that book that it was still available in Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland and worldwide. Is that right?
Yeah.
I mean, that is crazy. That must have felt incredibly frustrating to think that if you lived 3 hours in a different, my geography's dreadful, by the way, so that might be completely wrong where you are. But say me in Liverpool, if this was my child, so if I lived an hour down the road, so I was in Wales, I would, you know, my child would be eligible for that surgery. That can't feel nice.
Well, actually, when we got to Alder Hey, the doctors there and the staff there were saying it's just so hard because we know we're getting patients from England in that waiting room, and we're getting, because we're kind of on the border, we're getting patients from Wales also coming for the same appointment, and they're both walking out with very different outcomes.
Oh, hang on. So the hospital in England can do the operation if the patient lives in Wales? Oh, that's crazy. Oh, that, yeah. So technically then you could be sat, as you've used Alder Hey as an example, so I will, that's our local hospital. I feel we're very, very lucky to be like 20 minutes down the road from it. So you could literally be sat next to a child with exactly the same thing and one gets the surgery and one doesn't, purely based on a postcode.
Yeah, it's a funding lottery. So the NHS were tasked with a cost-cutting mission. And they basically just looked at what they could axe. And because there was no evidence backing up that pectus surgery was beneficial to the cardiopulmonary function of a patient's chest, it was like, well, that can go. But what they did was, and actually me and Mark left that conference exhausted, but so upset, because they'd said, it was brilliant news because they had all these officials. So they had an official from NHS Specialised Commissioning. They had the cardiothoracic lead, national lead. And they said, look, we are working on it. We are pushing. This is what we're proposing. And then they put the slides up and said, we're going to try and start like a minimised service. So this is our proposal, our draft proposal for the new pathway. It's got very clear criteria. So the criteria was the Haller index needs to be greater than 3.25.
Which Bobby's was, wasn't it? You said, was it 4.2?
4.3 to begin with.
4.3.
They need to be having cardiac impairment that's proved by scan. Dysphagia, which I didn't know at the time what that meant. So dysphagia,
what
is,
does that mean?
Trouble swallowing, or it can be detrimental to any other surgery that you need. So if they needed to get into the chest to do heart or lung surgery and that was in the way, then that would be a contributing factor. And I just remember looking at it and thinking, God, like, as it stands, my son doesn't have, I mean, I knew he had the dysphagia because he's always had eating issues. He's always been painfully skinny. And I thought, he's got that. But I was looking at it thinking, well, yeah, his Haller index is 4.3, but he hasn't got any proven heart impairment. So we walked away and we said, what you've done is instead of, I mean, they'd already done that. They'd already tarred everybody with the same brush and put everybody in the same category. It's cosmetic. But then following this meeting, it was like, there is a cosmetic element, you know, that could be helped with psychological support, physio. And then there's this device called a vacuum bell, which works with suction. You know, just put it on the chest and pump it up. So for some of the milder cases, they could use a vacuum bell. Then there was like an intermediate category where, and this was just my understanding of it, patients had a severe Haller index, patients were had some degree of health detriment, but nothing was kind of proved. And then there was a very, very severe end. So remember, there was this, they were saying there was one little girl who had a Haller index of 20 and she was going to school in a wheelchair because she was fainting all the time. Oh. And I just thought, how can you do this to these kids? Like, it's just cruel. So we come away feeling a bit defeated, but then I kind of regrouped. I had a word with myself and thought, no, I'm gonna get to work on this. So long story short is he got through on the dysphagia. That's why he ended up having his surgery.
I've just got one question going back to the conversations that you were having in London and, you know, what the criteria was to be suitable, as they would term it, to have this operation. Was people's mental health ever, not by the parents, but by the doctors, was that ever taken into consideration? Because that, yes, they can kind of fob it off by going, it's cosmetic. But I would imagine that for a lot of people, that does have an impact on their mental health because it's physical and everybody can see.
A lot of the patients do have psychological detriment from having a chest wall malformation, because there's another condition as well called, this is pectus excavatum goes in, but there's also another condition called pectus carinatum that goes out. So that's not funded at all anywhere, because they believe that there's a brace that can push that down. They believe that could be really quite effective. Psychological detriment isn't listed as part of the criteria for surgery. And I know from people I've spoken to from working on the charity, that there's people are really impacted psychologically from how their chest looks, from how breathless they are. Do you know, it's a lot of these very, very severe patients, they're getting the surgery, which is brilliant. But that middle category who aren't quite just getting there or aren't quite just bad enough on their tests, it's like, you know, they could be breathless, they could be not a bit and being able to keep up with friends, they could be their daily activities could be really minimized by their condition. So that also has, that ramps up the psychological effect. Looking at the system now, there's a big push towards psychological services and the mental health impact of these conditions. So they really are taking it very seriously. But yeah, that it just wasn't taken into account when they were writing that pathway.
Yeah, it's a shame that, isn't it? So how long ago did Bobby have the operation?
So he had the operation on the 4th of June last year. And it was a really difficult decision because obviously we'd built a rapport with Mr. Dunning. He was absolutely brilliant. Mm-hmm. He'd just done everything that he could to help us. But then Bobby was 15. So we were like, oh, he's got his GCSEs coming up. He's missed a lot of school already.
And yeah, it's a big year, isn't it?
He was only doing 3 days. That's all he could manage, 3 days at school.
Right, okay.
So we were like, you know, if we're going to give him the best chance at getting through these GCSEs, it kind of needs to be now. But Bobby really wanted to go and have his surgery with Joel, Mr. Dunning. But when we went to Alderhay for the test, he was like, oh, like, I really like it here, because, I mean, I'm assuming you've been.
Oh, God, I've been many times to Alderhay, many, many times. We're there all the time.
But when we walked in, we were just like, oh, my God, this place is so magical. And as we walked in, we were met by, like, a therapy dog. And then we went into the rooms, and the rooms have got, like, projected aquariums all over the walls. And everybody's just so kind and just so lovely, and it's all about the kids. We decided to do it there in the end, and I'm so glad we did, because it just breezed through it. But that's one thing that's just been like a trending theme through his life. He's just been so resilient and versatile. He just rolls with the punches. He'd just come out of surgery, he let's go into recovery, and he just woke up with this biggest smile on his face, giving his dad abuse. So he had all the nurses laughing. And then he come back to the ward and he said to me, I'm starving. And I was just like, oh my God, this is brilliant. He sat there in bed with this cinnamon swirl as big as his head, scoffing the cinnamon swirl. It left after 4 days. It recovered so fast. But then that was kind of short-lived because 2 months after his surgery, he went out for the first time with his friends and he got spontaneously attacked, knocked unconscious. He ended up with a huge laceration in his lip, needed 10 stitches. And I was just like, oh my God, like, how could this happen? You go through the motions, like, should I have let him out? What could I have done differently? And it literally was just some thug said, you've let the tyres down on my bike. And Bobby was walking backwards with his hands up. He's not a fighter. The friends that he was with were lovely guys. And he just said, I don't know anything about your bike. And this guy just punched him. I got to the place where he was. And one of the mums said, you do realise he was unconscious, don't you? And I was like, no. So I was just like, and then shortly after, I'd emailed the surgeon and I said, I'm not sure if he's landed on his bar. Because there's now some chest changes in the shape of his chest. So we went back to Alder Hey and he said, look, what do you want to do? And Bobby said, the operation's worked. I can eat, I can breathe, I can play football. I'm back at school 5 days with extra revision sessions. I've qualified for the British Indoor Karting Championships. So we said, there's no point in doing anything else. It's functional. And I was just like, oh my God, who are you and what have you done with Bobby? Like, you're so mature.
That must have made you really proud.
Oh, and it's just, you look at him now, he's got a girlfriend, he's got a job. He's just done his GCSEs, he's going to the gym. It's just an absolute joy. And, you know, he's just an inspiration and such a good role model for his brother, because they do everything together, and everything Bobby wants to do, Billy wants to do.
How much of an impact would you say it's had on his life and his quality of life and what he's able to do? The operation, I mean.
It's been life-changing, definitely. He's a totally different person. And I remember having this discussion with Mr. Dunning, and I said he's had his follow-up, he's had his last paediatric lung function test. And the surgeon hugged him, bless him. And he was like, oh, I can't believe I won't be seeing you anymore. You'd be going to adult if you need anybody. And his lung function was increased minimally, which they think is probably due to his growth because his lungs got a little bit bigger again. And I'd mentioned this to Mr. Dunning and he said, yeah, but don't, why are you focusing on that? He said, you need to focus on what you see in front of you. Like, look at what he's doing. Like, there was a point where we were thinking, God, I don't think we'll even get him through school. Like, he's just so knackered. I couldn't get him up in the morning. Every morning was just an argument. I'd be like, Bobby, get up, Bobby, get up, Bobby, get up. Oh, no, I don't want to. Can't be bothered. You can't compare the two people. He's just a different person.
And I guess that right there is why that surgery should be available on the NHS, isn't it?
Yeah. But he kind of led me on to something new because we got put together as a focus group off the back of that conference to feed into NHS discussions about how we should progress with Pectus care. And we kind of just all got to the point, I think it was about 4 or 5 of us at that point, and we just said, let's just set up a charity. So I was actually the co-founder of the first ever UK Pectus charity. So I was just like, God, this kid is just teaching me things that I never thought I could do. Didn't even know the last thing about running a charity or...
It's amazing. Where is it up to now then? Is it still the same that you have to tick all of those boxes, and if you don't, then you can't have the surgery?
Yeah. So basically what we're hoping is they're going to look at the pathway again. So it's called the interim pathway at the moment. I want to see those words change to permanent pathway.
Yeah.
But we were very lucky. Mr. Dunning is worked with a brilliant team to get his hands on £2 million for a clinical research trial. I think all the early group have been done, operated on now or thereabouts, and then there's a late group. So where they observe their symptoms over a year to see if anything changes, and then they'll get their surgery after a year. So what they're going to do is they're going to collate all that data, and then that's going to be used to inform the new pathway. But my argument has always been, it's still really not where it should be. It's still not good enough because in the meantime, it could take up to 5 years. In the meantime, there's still people suffering. You know, there's still mums who can't go to work. There's still mums who are also having psychological issues because they just can't cope with the kids not being able to do things and not being able to eat, walk, breathe, you know.
Becky, what's the charity called?
It's called Pectus Matters.
I'm going to get you to send me the link to that and I will put that in the show notes so that everyone can easily find that. I always finish the podcast, as you know, with the same two questions. The first being, and I guess you kind of already answered this, so I guess you can say the same thing if you want. What is the best piece of advice that you've been given?
So actually, apart from what I said before about what the anaesthetist said, keeping well exercised, the best piece of advice I was given was just be guided by him. You know, as a mum, you kind of just want to swaddle them and make it right and protect them. But actually, sometimes that veered me away from actually letting him be in control of his own path.
That's brilliant advice. I really like that. And then what do you wish you had known at the beginning of this journey that you know now?
I've written this down because we had a family discussion about this. So what I've put here is actually, it sounds a bit arrogant to say, but as a parent, I always know Bobby's going to be okay. It's like, I've got you, you know, you're my responsibility. I'm going to take good care of you. I'm going to do anything I can. So it seems a bit selfish to say, but it was more from my perspective as a mum. And I wish I kind of knew then that you just can't pour from an empty pot.
I've
exhausted myself, not only trying to help Bobby, now trying to help other families. And what I've done is I've broken away from the charity now and I want to focus more on parents and patients and just that grassroots level. And I'm sick of policy, I'm sick of politics. And my strengths lie with helping others and sharing our journey and sharing our story. So, yeah, I have a mantra now. So my mantra is rest, don't quit.
I love that mantra. And I think a lot of people listening should take on that mantra because it's so easy to feel burnt out by it and feel like you can't take a breath, isn't it?
Yeah. And if you're knackered and stressed and narky, you know, good to the person that you're trying to help, you know.
Absolutely. Well, Becky, I have to say, I think you're really inspirational, you and Bobby. I think the fact that you've taken on this fight and you're trying to invite change and make it better for other people, not, you know, I would never judge anyone for doing this. You haven't just gone, my kid's fine, brilliant, I can stop. And I think, well done you.
Well, you've got to pay it forward, haven't you? You know, what's the point in having pain if it can't help someone else?
Absolutely. And hopefully it will be successful and you will get what you're fighting for and what absolutely should happen. So thank you so much, Becky. Listen, if there's anything else, any other resources or anything that you think would be helpful to people listening, just send them over to me and I'll put those all in the show notes as well as the charity. And it's been so lovely to chat to you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thanks, Becky.
Take care.
So once again, and this is becoming a bit of a theme here, I have learned so much there from speaking to Becky. She was talking about things that I'd never heard of. I didn't know you could put in an individual funding request. I'd never heard of an IHCP, only an EHCP. And I think maybe if I haven't heard of one of those, maybe you haven't heard of one of those either. And maybe that's something that could be really appropriate for your child rather than jumping to the EHCP immediately. Like Becky said, it's like a step down. So, you know, in theory, I guess easier to get one of those. And that's one of the things that I love about doing this podcast is that not only am I speaking to amazing, inspirational women like Becky and hearing these wonderful stories and stories of these incredibly resilient children, I'm also learning so much along the way, and I'm learning not only terminology like I've just said there, but I'm learning about diagnoses and conditions and things that would never ever have crossed my path had I not had Leo and then decided to do this podcast. So I'm taking all of that as a huge positive. I hope you enjoyed the episode. I love chatting to Becky. Thank you again to her for taking the time to talk to me. And like I said, the charity and any other resources that Becky is going to send me will be in the show notes. So that's it for another episode. As always, I'd love it if you would follow, subscribe, whatever it is, how your podcast app works. That's free. It doesn't cost anything at all. It just helps more people to find us. As it would do if you would rate and review, I would really appreciate that. Thank you so much. And I'll see you next week with another amazing guest. Mm-hmm.